Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for this week's podcast is Paul English. He's a software veteran who's been VP of technology at Intuit. He runs the internet travel search engine kayak.com, but he's probably best known for the IVR cheat sheet, now available at gethuman.com. This popular database of voice system shortcuts makes it easier for people to get the human assistance they crave when calling customer service centers. The Get Human project isn't just a list of IVR hacks anymore. It's evolved into a consumer movement that publishes best practices for quality phone service and rates companies' adherence to those best practices. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. How are you?
So I was just reviewing the database and noticing that there are a preponderance of Fs and Ds.
Yeah, unfortunately, the grades didn't go too well.
Did you just add those?
No. The database as it exists today with the grades, well, that's the first round of grades. I guess, I don't know if you had caught when we published those. I think it was probably about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
It was a huge amount of work, actually, to come up with a system for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We had called each company, I think, about 16 times during various times of the day.
Okay.
And we graded them based on the criteria. It's kind of the Get Human standard that we put together, based on a poll of consumers we put on our site as far as which things are important to them. And yeah, you look at the results and it looks pretty miserable.
When I first heard about what used to be called IVR cheat sheet,
yep.
I think it got a lot of press about a year and a half ago or something like that.
That sounds right, about a year ago, yep.
But it had been percolating for a while before that, obviously, as a kind of a personal project, I guess. What got you started on doing that?
I think a couple of things. I mean, like most consumers, this issue is one which really frustrates me. And everyone I talk to, I think the reason this thing was kind of the big story last year is that it's an issue which resonates with everyone. Everyone gets frustrated. And this is something that each of us experiences probably a few times a week.
Oh, yeah. It absolutely touched a nerve with lots of people. And the notion of hacking your way around it was just so appealing.
Yeah. So it really just was born out of my own frustration. I'm a pretty frequent blogger. And when I see something that annoys me or something could be done better, I'll frequently just blog about it. And when I had first gotten fed up with these phone systems, I kind of poked around on the web and found some information, did some experiments. And my first blog posting was really small. It had about 10 companies on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I got such a positive reaction that I decided to say, hey, let's really ramp this thing up.
So for people who might not have heard about this, what we're talking about here is the database that you've put together of cheats for hacking through voicemail systems, essentially getting straight to a human operator.
That's right.
So one of the questions that it raises is, have you now created a kind of an arms race where if these things are published, then they'll just work around them? And
it does happen, but particularly when what it's now called the Get Human database, so it's like gethuman.com. And particularly when it first got national attention, started getting a lot of press, companies would change the numbers so that the cheats that we listed wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But as soon as a company changed it, one of their employees would email me and basically say, I work in tech support for such and such a company. We just changed our system. Here's the new code. Don't tell anyone that I told you. And of course, I would just verify and put it right up on the site immediately. And I think the companies gave up. They realized that there's no way they could change the systems without one of their employees ratting them out.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at this from another perspective. You give someone an A if when you call, a human answers, right?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's possible to get an A without having a human answer. I think there are 10 key items that we have in the standard, and we rate each company on each of those 10 items.
Okay.
So, for example, even if you don't have a human answer,
mm-hmm.
You should let people always just say operator to get to a human or to dial zero when they want.
Yeah.
Now, I'm an engineer myself, so I like technology. I'm not anti-technology. And there are many phone systems where the IVR system works quite well. And there are many cases where I prefer using the IVR as opposed to talking to a human.
When it works properly.
Yeah. And based on the application, if you call an airline and you're looking for flight arrival time because you're picking a friend up at the airport,
mm-hmm.
The IVR works quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking to change a reservation, get me to an operator.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I find most insulting with these systems, you know, dignity is defined in some way as giving people the right to make decisions. And the fact that, in particular, if it's a company that I'm paying, you know, $100 a month for cable TV or cell phone or whatever, and they don't give me the ability to decide when I want to use the IVR and when to talk to a human,
mm-hmm.
I just find it really insulting, particularly if I'm paying them $100 a month.
Well, what also extremely annoys me is this deal where the first thing that you do is enter your account number and other information, which if it were retained and used properly, I would be thrilled with.
Yeah.
But it seems that it never is, you know, so that handoff is always fumbled. And it seems that almost without exception, I type in all these digits and then I finally get to someone and they ask me to repeat all the same information that I just typed in. So that's just a failure of IT.
Yeah, it used to make me crazy. And when I would get the operator, what I used to say, she would say, can you tell me a 16-digit account number? And I would say, do you mean the 16-digit account number that I just entered into your system?
Yeah.
And she says, yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
And then I would say, does that one not occur to you? Did you not see that? And she'd say, no. I would say, don't you think that your company should have that occur to you so you don't have to waste time talking about that right now? And I ended up talking to them for about 5 minutes. And, of course, the rep was getting kind of pissed off because they're paid on, you know, number of transactions I process.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized, you know, it's not really the rep's fault. And I was hoping the reps would complain, you know, to their bosses going, God, this is ridiculous. How much time are you wasting of ours? But after doing this for a bit, I developed some empathy for the customer support reps.
Oh, absolutely.
Those aren't the guys empowered to make the decisions to make this stuff happen. It
absolutely
really goes all the way up to the CEO, who, you know, makes, in many cases, the terrible decision of running customer service as a cost center,
yeah,
which means that the VP who runs customer service, their $100,000 a year bonus, whatever they get paid, is based on one thing, and that's shaving pennies off the cost per call.
Agreed. And it is a tragedy because customer service is a huge opportunity for business differentiation. If we set up this sort of false dichotomy, which is it's either automated or it's human, then we're missing out on what the real opportunity is, I think, which is to be able to connect the right people to the right circumstance at the right time.
Yep.
That's a very tricky and challenging thing to orchestrate, but
yep,
it's exactly what ought to be happening. And it just, I don't know, there just doesn't seem to be any vision for how to do that. And it's partly an IT problem and it's partly a cultural problem, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, at a higher level, I think it's an attitude about how you think about your customers and how you treat your customers. And it seems like, in particular, you know, the cable TV companies, the phone companies, they think they're doing me a big favor, you know, by providing me the service. And, like, I should, you know, really be thankful. Gee, I really appreciate you providing me this cable connection to my TV. And it's, you know, they don't consider service as part of that. And I just, it just boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm. I also had an interesting experience that made me think a little bit about the cost effectiveness of having eyeballs on transactions. I was booking some travel recently and it triggered an alert. And I wound up talking to someone who is in a branch office of a travel company. And through some unusual set of circumstances, she winds up actually reviewing all of the transactions that flow through her office. It's a small number of them and she can actually do that. So she told me that she catches one or two frauds a week just because, as a human being, her wetware pattern recognizer is able to do that. And her observation was that in larger operations, the stuff is just written off. It's just kind of waste, you know,
that's
that
right.
it, you know what I mean? And it just kind of made me wonder, we sort of assume that it's always cost ineffective to involve a human being.
Right.
But that assumption should be questioned.
Yeah, it really, I mean, I just think companies don't think about this correctly in terms of the value of their employees' time and talking to customers. I mean, I run a small internet travel company, kayak.com. I guess we're not so small anymore, but we're a few years old. And we have 30 employees, and last month we had 10 million unique user searches across the site. And even with just 32 employees and no customer service department, most of our employees are engineers developing the website,
mm-hmm,
any inquiry we get to our company, most of which is by email, but some by phone as well, but any inquiry we get gets a personal reply.
Hmm.
And you might say, how's that possible, you know, for 10 million unique user queries a month to be any questions about those to be answered by 32 mostly engineers?
How is it possible?
Well, it's a big secret. And the secret is, I'll tell you the secret, it's that we made it a requirement,
yeah,
about a year and a half ago. And when I was kind of frustrated that there were some things about the site that I wasn't proud of that,
yeah,
were, you know, really kind of awkward and challenging to use. And I was trying to do all the customer support myself, and I was getting overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And so one day I had had it. And so I said, look, let's take down some features off the site until we can perfect the core features where we don't get questions anymore. And there was a lot of grumbling by engineers and by biz dev folks and other people in the company who said, you know, we don't have time for this. Can't you hire a customer service person? But I was pretty insistent. What happened is for a few weeks, there was no new code written at all because the engineers were so busy answering questions that they would get sick of answering the same question over and over. And the engineer would say, geez, you know, I better find a way to simplify this UI so I don't need to get any questions anymore. I think by having that religion and just making it a required part of how we operate, anytime we screw up and get behind on the usability curve, the phone calls and emails become overwhelming, mm-hmm. and we stop new development.
That's a great strategy. It's also noteworthy in this regard that at Craigslist, Craig Newmark is, I believe his title is Chief Customer Support.
That's awesome.
Right? I mean, I really think that's a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah.
You know, because when you get right down to it, that is, in many ways, coming to be the lone differentiator. You know, there are all sorts of other things that are just sort of commodities.
Yeah.
A really small difference in price between one commodity service and another isn't going to tip the scales. But, a hugely favorable perception of a positive customer service experience is something that really will tip the scales.
Yeah, and I like Craigslist. It's definitely one of the sites that really inspires me. And one of the nice things about it, even from the early days and all the way up to now, is you get the sense that there's really a guy called Craig, mm-hmm. Behind that. It's not just the name of the site, but it has just a really good feel to it. And I think a lot of products evolve like that, where the founders really care about this and they're talking to customers all the time.
Yeah.
We have a thing at Kayak where once a week we publish an internal chart just by email that shows for every employee how many customer service emails they answered and what was their average response time.
Yeah.
And it sounds a little aggressive to do that, but it's just, you know, one more thing I do to try to communicate to the employees that this stuff really matters to me.
Yeah.
And we have a, you know, list of who's the most prolific of the week and who's the fastest of the week. And if I'm not number one each week, I'm probably number two. It's pretty important to me, and it's become pretty important to the whole company. And I think it's helped us a lot in terms of evolving the product to be so simple that we don't get that many questions.
Yeah. Well, there's also an aspect of the qualitative nature of the interaction. It's subtle, but incredibly important. I think about 6 years ago now, I bought a lawnmower from a company called Clean Air Gardening. And I had some questions about it. It's an old-fashioned reel lawnmower that you push, right?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I had some questions about it early on, and I wrote to support@cleanairgardening.com, and I heard back from this guy, Lars.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I mean, every once in a while, something has come up, and I've written to support@cleanairgardening.com, and it's been Lars who wrote back, you know, and it's just...
Oh, God, that's so great. Yeah, that's very cool. It definitely makes it, you know, you a lot more loyalty, I think, as a customer. And the case I've made to CEOs as I talk to them about customer service is that even though it costs a little bit more money to have humans available to answer the phones when the customers want to do it, if you have humans who answer the phone, and those humans have a sense of humor, maybe they're even a little bit irreverent, but they try really hard to answer that question without transferring you again and again and again.
Yeah.
It generates loyalty where, as a consumer, I'm going to come back more often. I'll be least likely to cancel my account even if I'm upset about something.
Yeah.
And I'll recommend it to my friends.
Yeah.
And it's hard to measure that sometimes, but you know, it's a pretty obvious connection you can make.
One of the ways that this can evolve is that, from my perspective, it would be great if Lars had a blog.
Yep.
To the extent that people talk about corporate blogging, I think they see it in terms of marketing. And well, actually, I would say that if Lars had a blog, it would be a form of marketing, but it would be the most effective form, which is that because he's obviously answered the same question that I've asked him many times. You know, how cool would it be if when I wrote to him, he sent me back a link to the posting where he had answered that question, and then there were comments from other people attached to it who had further reflections and so on. And, you know, I haven't really seen an example of that yet, but it seems like an obvious next step to me and a really nice and natural thing to do.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, that gives me an idea. I wonder if the emails that I reply to customers, we have our own system that we designed, which I've designed several customer service systems. I actually really enjoy doing customer support, and I've run customer support groups for many, many years as part of my software companies. But we've developed our own for Kayak, which there's some, you know, tricky parts of it that allow us to do the volume that I've described pretty mm-hmm. efficiently. But it makes me wonder, maybe when I send replies to customers, maybe there's a little checkbox I put into myself which says obscure, you know, obviously anything related to the customer and their itinerary and whatnot, but post this one up on my blog so that people can see, here's how I'm answering the questions day to day that we're getting.
Oh, absolutely, because among other things, what you would find happening with increasing frequency is that the replies to people would be URLs.
Yeah, yeah.
To former content that is answering the question, and then that starts to build up this sort of critical mass. It starts to become a knowledge base.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I've done that for my personal website, for my blog. I lecture in Boston every now and then on entrepreneurship and starting companies, and I therefore end up getting lots and lots of questions about it. People starting companies asking for advice, and I do pretty much reply to that and give them an URL and say, you know, here's an article I wrote about hiring or raising venture or whatever.
Yeah.
But I haven't really thought about doing that. We have a frequently asked questions list, mm-hmm. but actually having the raw answers, the way we talk about them to customers and making those available in an easy way is a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, it would be. How much activity is happening on the Get Human database?
So I have a woman who runs it for me now. Her name is Lorna Rankin, and she pretty much runs the site, and she's calling companies and answering questions from users, anything about the site of these companies, taking suggestions from users about here's a new tip for mm-hmm. company. In addition, she has two other volunteers, Walter Verlandi and Walt Teschner, mm-hmm. who work with us to poll users and produce updates to the standard itself in terms of how phone systems should work.
Yeah.
And then most recently, Lorna has started running the rating system. And we actually have some subcontractors that she uses that place calls for these companies every day to try to rate them on how many seconds it takes them.
No kidding.
To answer, how long their prompts are. I mean, there's a whole bunch of criteria that they call these companies to rate them. So even if a company gets an F today, it's possible for them in the next month's publishing to do much better. And all they need to do is look at the 10 standards we have listed, which are driven by consumers, and to improve themselves on one or more of those 10 criteria.
So how many people have input ratings, and how many people are using the service, as far as you can tell?
Well, at its peak last year, when this really started hitting national press, we were over 1 million unique users per month visiting the site.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty huge. Today it's about, let me just think, it's about 5,000 to 10,000 a day. So maybe it's about, okay. you know, what's that, 200,000, 300,000 a month. So it's yeah. a lot less, but it's still pretty solid.
Yeah.
So those are the people who are accessing the database. As far as people that are providing input to it, I think we probably do about 50 to 100 emails a day.
So one of the things I noticed in the original version of it is that it was a QuickBase database.
That's correct.
And I was poking around on your site, and I see that you are a QuickBase fan, which I think is quite interesting. It's not an application that seems to be very well known. And there have actually this year been a couple of new entrants into the sort of web database category, which I think is starting to bring some more mainstream attention to the concept. But in one of your postings, I think you sort of nailed the essence of it, which is that for basic CRUD, you know, create, read, update, delete operations, the web is perfectly adequate for the typical database, which is quite modest in size. And that the key point is that, however, when you do it through the web, you have shareable data, right? You have, it was kind of that same idea. Here's an URL to this view that I can give someone else.
Yeah, I mean, you can also think of it as a structured wiki. The reason I use QuickBase for the first IVR cheat sheet was precisely that it allowed me to put a list out there and put a bunch of energy into it, but then anyone on the web could go and update it.
Yeah.
Full disclosure, QuickBase was developed by a team of mine at Intuit. When I was VP technology there, it was actually this guy named Joe Rice, who was the inventor, and he had a company, small company outside of Boston called Turning Mill Software
mm-hmm.
that we acquired at Intuit. To this day, it is absolutely, you know, one of my favorite apps. And one of the, you know, I think Gmail is probably the app I use more than anything else, because mm-hmm. that's what I'm using for my email these days. But QuickBase is probably number two or number three in terms of most used by me. And it's, I just think it's a killer app.
And yet, it's interesting, yours was the first QuickBase URL that I'd ever followed, which tells me that it's not really widely used yet.
Yeah, I think it's a little frustrating to me because it's such a killer product. I would like to have seen Intuit push it more to the mass market. What Intuit has done, QuickBase is part of the small business division at Intuit.
Yeah, it's a little expensive for individuals.
Yeah, it's intentional, though. Because Intuit's making most of their money these days from small business customers, QuickBooks, and people who graduate from QuickBooks,
yeah.
and the professional tax products, Intuit has really aimed QuickBase at that market, but also at the larger of the small businesses. And so they've kind of dropped the consumer market or the really small business market for some of the new web products, including QuickBase. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's a little sad because I do think it's such a great app. I'd like to have seen Intuit push it out across all markets. But I think it's one of these things where you have to focus. And
mm-hmm.
The team who's running QuickBase these days thought there's a much better business for them in providing this to larger businesses. And that's where their focus is today.
Well, that may change as there starts to emerge competition at the low end of that market, which is
yeah.
Which
I mean,
is
even you look
now.
At Google Documents, Google Spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I like that it's Google, so I feel some security. It's going to be around for a while. It's going to work and all that. But you know, it's just an example where with Web 2.0, people are seeing collaboration and web-based, where everything's available at any PC you're at, is the way to go. QuickBase has been around for about 5 years now,
mm-hmm.
and you're right that there's some new entrance into the space because it's an obvious way to do things these days. And whether QuickBase itself will be the killer app for consumers or it's going to be Google Spreadsheets or something else, I don't know. But it's clearly the way we need to move.
Agreed. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, I noticed that your consulting fees go to Partners in Health.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about that organization. I've heard of it, but I don't know much about it.
Sure. Partners in Health, I've been working with them for about 5 years now. It's a nonprofit organization based in Boston. I think their mission is to give preferential health options to the poor. One of the things that I've learned through my work in Partners in Health is that the reason there's a lot of deaths due to HIV, tuberculosis, and AIDS, and malaria, you know, to the tune of about 10 million kids a year, and the reason there's so many of this in poor regions is that if you are living in poverty and you're not getting proper nutrition and protein, you might not have clean water, and there's some basic life essentials that are lacking a little bit, you as a person and your family and your community is going to be ripe for disease. And the meds that are available, you know, if I develop HIV and I take the meds in Boston, because the essentials of clean water and protein and all that, and, you know, having adequate ventilation and a house that protects me from rain and a concrete floor or wood floor instead of having, you know, a dirt floor, those basic elements will allow me to be healthy enough that the medicines will work and I can keep my HIV under control. However, if I live in rural Haiti where I have none of those things, the drugs don't work. And what Partners in Health has done is figured out a way, not through new drugs, but through new ways of looking at the whole patient and the whole life of the patient and creating advocacies within each of the villages to look at all of those elements of a person's life. And when you really manage that, it's not something you think of as an MD in Boston worrying about, but in the developing countries, you really do need to worry about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can build an organization and a process which takes care of some of those other issues, the meds are magic and the
mm-hmm.
meds will work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just found them to be very inspirational in terms of how much work they've done with extraordinarily small amount of funding. So it's been a huge part of my life over the last few years.
I put the Tracy Kidder book on my wish list.
Yeah, it's a great book, The Mountains Beyond Mountains, his book about Paul Farmer, who's the doctor who co-founded Partners in Health.
Yeah, yeah. I have no further questions. It's been a treat to talk to you about this stuff. I've been wanting to do it for a while.
All right, sure.
Thanks, I appreciate your time.
All right, great.
Okay, take care.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.